Welcome to A Lot Going On with Raj Kotecha. In today's episode, we have a solo one because we have an interesting interview request from Majid at Visionary Magazine. I've owed this person the answers to these questions for a long time, and so I figured it might just be easier to A, speak it because it's easier than typing for me, and then B, share it on A Lot Going On so that you guys can then, if you want to, go and check out the link in the description in YouTube or on Spotify and go and support this incredible guy's magazine. I'm really interested to do it. I've not seen the questions for quite some weeks, but when I did see them, I thought they were some of the best questions I've been asked. And so the benefit of today is I've kind of erased from my memory what they are because it's been some time. And my colleague Marianne behind the camera is gonna ask the questions, which you'll hear, and then I'll answer them. So Marianne, let's go through Majid's questions. How many do we have?
11.
11, okay, brilliant. Let's go through them.
All right, first question. What was your first ever job?
My first ever job by default was working in my dad's shop. So I had a typical East African Indian lifestyle, which is that my grandparents were from Gujarat, India. My parents moved to Kenya, and then I was raised in the UK. And so as an East African Asian, a lot of generations opened shops, and therefore a lot of my generation's first jobs was working in that shop. It was not paid. You could even argue it was voluntary. It's just the first job that we all had by default. Stacking shelves, sitting behind the counter, watching my grandfather sell sweets and things of that nature, going to the cash and carry, loading up the shelves, and just generally getting used to the relationship between handing goods over a counter and taking some money.
Cool. So your parents and grandparents cultivated an experience from living in India, East Africa, and then the UK. What are the most important lessons you learned from them?
The honest answer, which I've not told people before, is that you need to work twice as hard as English people, because the time where I was growing up in the 80s, there were certain pockets where Indians and South Asians did really, really well, specifically places like London, where you saw a lot of the community go into like pharmacy, becoming doctors, accountants, lawyers. And then there were other more working class communities where many of us were still kind of like working class. And so we were much more on par and level with the local community. So where I grew up in Salford, which is like the west side of Manchester, was quite racist, quite rough, and quite working class. And so therefore you would always not be given the same opportunities, whether directly or indirectly, than British people. And so one of the big lessons that was always passed down, not just from like my family, but also from the other few minorities that lived in that town, and we're talking about less than a dozen, you know, people of color. So one Jamaican guy, one Chinese family, one Pakistani family, a couple of Gujarati families, and one Punjabi family, were that based on the reality that they knew, which was the 80s, is that you're gonna need to work twice as hard, get the best possible grades you can, work longer hours, make sure that you're extra well dressed up, even if you're going for an interview at McDonald's, which is me, because I used to wear suits when I went to McDonald's and got turned down from three of those. And that was the number one lesson, is just work hard, study hard. And also I think outside the professional world, just being like kind and generous. I think being a minority and seeing other people move to the country and other cousins come to study is just kind of leave an open door for people. We used to take a lot of pride in like feeding people and hosting people. So they would be the main lessons.
How are you able to balance between studying business and running a party promotion operation for 3 years?
So the 3 to 5 years that I was at university, including my master's, the balance was very, very natural. They much more locked into each other than balance. So this question is to do with the fact that I had a big kind of promotional crew in Manchester when I was studying there from 98 to 2003. And I had a crew called Love Garage, and we would launch like garage music, like Monster Boy featuring Denzi, which is a very big song, I'm Sorry, and also A Little Bit of Luck with DJ Luck and MC Neat. We helped launch that single. So the way I was able to balance it is that I was actually applying everything I was learning in the day in my lectures straight into my work at night. So at night, street level promotion, where you're stood outside venues at 1, 2, 3 in the morning handing out flyers, you've really got to try and get people's attention. And one area I excelled in my business degrees was in marketing. So in marketing, when they teach me about things like USPs and branding and all that kind of stuff, that would immediately impact the kind of flyers I designed and the way that I marketed my content, the way I put posters together. So it wasn't really a balance. It was more of a flowing relationship from academia down into like immediate application into what I was doing at night as a music promoter and nightlife promoter.
What made you want to keep working and establish an agency after your exit instead of taking a break?
So the exit I was involved in was in 2008, a company called Paid Content sold to The Guardian. It's still documented online as a really kind of amazing Web 2.0 era publishing acquisition. The reason that I kept working is, number one, the money was like, you know, enough to get rid of any debts, but not like change your life, go buy a house money. So that's number one, is that the money would have run out soon enough. And number two, I think at 28 years old, I was still buzzing off the opportunity that London had. It was definitely one of my first big wins in my career, but nowhere near enough reason to consider stop working, especially because I derive so much enjoyment from working. I still get the buzz from like seeing cash change hands for products or cash change hands for services, or eventually money and money wires change hands for services. So that's one thing that's inherently something that gives me joy and pleasure. And 28 years old was no age to quit. In fact, even now at 43, it's no age to quit. I just think it's a part of a lifestyle. When you grow up in a shop, the sound of a cash register ringing or a doorbell ringing as the door opens, as customers get let in, is as much a native sound as any other native sound. So I think it's just, it's in my DNA. No reason to stop working yet.
You met Fat Joe and DJ Khaled at a music conference in Miami. Can you share the story behind that with us?
Yeah, that's a crazy story. So I don't think I've ever told this story before. I think I was in Mansion in Miami in 2003 or four, maybe 2003. And I was at Mobile Music Con, which was a conference. So at that time, my job in Canada was I helped start the first independent ringtones portal in Canada. And Canada did not have lots of license deals for music. So for example, different kind of like songs that were big at the time, like 50 Cent, Black Eyed Peas, and Fat Joe as well, to be fair. So I had to go into America to negotiate with license holders to figure out how to get that, those music licenses brought north of the border to Canada, which meant going to a lot of music conferences, which was brilliant, right down my alley. I love music. And one night after one of the conferences, my boss Naresh and I ended up in Mansion, and I recognized Fat Joe and DJ Khaled, and they were all just kind of like hanging out and doing their thing. And what I remember about that is they were with Kool and Dre, which are two famous producers that are tightly associated to Terror Squad, Fat Joe's crew. And I remember Dre being like incredibly smart and thoughtful. And my DJ Khaled story was interesting because DJ Khaled actually took me outside, separated me from the rest of the people in the club, and asked me everything that I was doing with regards to ringtones and music licensing. And he was just inherently curious and interested, and definitely like clearly a keen business person. And then the Fat Joe element was really crazy because I didn't speak to Fat Joe. Still to this day, I've ran into Fat Joe so many times and never had a conversation with him. The first time I saw Fat Joe, which was that night in the club, I remember being in the bathroom and like washing my hands, and Fat Joe walks in the club. He walked into the bathroom, and then the bouncer walked in directly after him and said, "Everybody out." So Fat Joe had cleared everybody out of the bathroom, and then the whole Terror Squad walked into the bathroom. I was one of the people that was leaving, and it looked like they'd called an emergency meeting for something or another. And quite frankly, I'm glad that I didn't stick around to hear what that meeting was about, because anybody that knows Fat Joe and Terror Squad knows that those guys are about it. And I wanted no parts of that. So yeah, that's my Fat Joe, Terror Squad, Kool and Dre, DJ Khaled story.
Being that you have a heavy interest in both hip hop and tech, where do you believe the two sectors intersect, and how do they influence each other?
The intersection of hip hop and technology really comes down to the people that advocate for both of those the most. So in hip hop, it's the hip hop artists and the breakdancers and DJs, graffiti writers and MCs. And in technology, it's the engineers and the entrepreneurs. And what I've noticed is with senior engineers and senior entrepreneurs, they really, really love hip hop music. It's because it's been so culturally important. And with people that have made it in hip hop, they really, really love technology and what's going on in that world, especially when it comes to like crypto and the web and ways to distribute their art. So I think the big overlap is the fact that at a certain point in both of those genres of life, they overlap and they look at each other and they're really keen to connect with each other. And finally, I would say that people that have done really, really well in the tech industry and people that have done really, really well in the hip hop industry are both considered mavericks. They've all beat the odds. They've all had to deal with adversity. They've all had to get people on board with things, new genres, new sounds, or new technologies that didn't exist prior to that person coming along. And I think the fact that they've had that uphill battle is a real overlap moment between those two communities.
What do you think about the hip hop scene in the Middle East and in Dubai to be specific? Where do you see it going in the future? And what factors do you believe it needs to blow up?
The hip hop scene in the UAE, the big elephant in the room is Soul DXB, which is a weekend long festival that happens at the beginning of December every year. If you really want to kind of do the litmus test on what's happening with the scene here, then you have to attend that. That festival is made up of global artists and legacy acts from hip hop and new artists. So I think the hip hop scene here, from a consumer point of view, there's always a lot of interest. There's always a lot of appetite. The kind of response that I saw to like Big Daddy Kane in the recent Soul DXB and Jadakiss shows that people do appreciate real hip hop music here. Also, there's such a tremendous amount of locally produced incredible hip hop talent, from Omar Effendim to Tak and all these other people that are coming up on the scene here. I think there's an appetite for that. One thing that I think the UAE scene still needs to plug in to its hip hop architecture is a little bit more like storytelling and behind the scenes. I think in the absence of like a real kind of like fist fight struggle that the original hip hop pioneers had in the 70s and 80s, the cats here in Dubai and UAE have got their own story that I think they need to open the book on a little bit. And the reality is that there's been as much successful hip hop music being made about the good life as there has been about hardship. And there's such a wonderful life here that we're still waiting on our Dubai anthems. I still want to hear about what kind of fun you can have rolling up and down Jumeirah Beach on the weekends, having fun. You know, there's incredible food here. There's incredible shopping here. There's incredibly beautiful people here. And I think that you can kind of tell that story the way that people tell like the Miami or the Vegas story and create some incredible anthems here. So I think that's one thing that we're still waiting on from the UAE music community. But I think when they do put that out, it's going to be really, really exceptional. And it's going to be great for Dubai because everyone's looking at this city at the moment anyway. And wrapping in some kind of like cultural high points would be awesome for the city. In fact, there's that song on Instagram where a lot of people use that song, One Night in Dubai. It's not a great song. It's a bit corny. But it shows how many people use it, how many people would use or would take advantage of the pride they have in music by having more songs about Dubai. And hip hop is the biggest genre in the world. So I think we're waiting for that crossover record, like how Will Smith did Miami. We're waiting for that moment for Dubai.
How do you feel about the impact of AI technology on creativity? Does it benefit or hinder creatives?
At the moment, the impact of AI on creativity is all focused around, at least from our perspective, from my perspective as an agency owner, it comes down to reducing costs. It's had an incredible impact on like lowering the cost of image creation and copywriting, because if you imagine it as a 10-stage process, you put in the first two steps. So it's like you put in the prompts and then this magic box that is AI jumps you forward 5 steps to 7. And spits you back out a 7 out of 10. And then your job is to finish it and put that human touch on to make it a 10. So I think when you see that 50% reduction in input or effort because AI is doing the work, I think that's having an incredible impact. So the way that I would explain it to you is, if you've ever seen someone play golf, you've got the tee where you tee off, and then you've got the green where you finally do those last couple of hits and do the putting. AI is that long journey in the middle, that sheer amount of grass that's covered. So the tee off is the prompt, and the finishing of the AI artifact, like the image or the text, is just the last few taps to get it into the hole. So I think AI has a profound impact. You know, we teach the 4 P's of content. How do you plan, produce, publish, and promote content? And when AI had its recent spike in the last couple of years, I really sat down and reflected and thought, which of the 4 P's does AI impact and how much? And the fact is, AI impacts plan, produce, publish, and promote in a tremendous way. I can only see the relationship between creativity and content and AI becoming more and more embedded and better threaded, whether it's AI doing research for you, pulling stats together for you, helping you write scripts. It's the biggest thing in the world since the mobile phone. So it's incredibly impactful.
You've lived and done business in all major cities in the world. Which one is at the top of your list and why?
Dubai is the major city for me of all the ones that I've worked or spent time in the world. And the reason is that we have just had so many things globally that have reshuffled the deck that originally dictated which the cities of power were. And in that reshuffling, Dubai has risen up that deck. So of course we all know that de facto pre-2020, when you ask about like tier A cities, you say London, New York, and then maybe Los Angeles, Singapore, Hong Kong, and a handful of others. I think now Dubai is in that kind of like London, New York, Dubai mix. It's definitely moved up into that top 3 to 5 cities in the world. Number one, it's close to 2/3 of the planet. You can travel there within 6 to 8 hours. It's got a domestic airline in Emirates. It's fully in charge of its own tourism. It's got a tremendous amount of safety. Setting up a company is becoming easier and easier. There's now a tax system, which is going to give a ton of people confidence in terms of bringing their businesses here, because now there's an open book and globally compliant policy when it comes to like fiscal responsibility. So I think Dubai is the top one. And remember, I spent time in New York in 99. I was in London heading into the great financial crisis in 2008 and beyond. And I've seen all these cities have like their time in the sun, but I've never seen it as good as Dubai because of the fact that society has that structure and that safety. I think it just gives you a much better platform than anywhere I've seen in the world to do business.
How did the idea for My Friends, Your Friends come about? And do you see the brand growing to become something beyond a network event?
The idea for My Friends, Your Friends came about when I was half living in Dubai, half living in London. And every time I'd go back to London for a short period of time, people from different communities would want to meet. So my friends in the music community would want to meet, tech community, media community. And because I was there for a limited period of time, if I spent time one-on-one with people, that would use up all of my time and I would get to spend no time, you know, working or with my parents. So I told people to come to King's Cross, which is, anybody who's been to Dubai knows that that's one of the kind of stations, train stations in London where all trains kind of pass through. And I was said I was going to be in a bar at that time, and I posted it on Facebook, and about 85 people came. So I was like, okay, this is an interesting idea. If 85 people will come to meet me in a bar and my friends, then who would come if I had like co-hosts and it wasn't just me? So I did that event a couple more times, and then I brought it to Dubai. And in March 2017, I got like a dozen co-hosts together. And again, funnily enough, it was about 85 people that showed up. And then we did it again in a different bar with different co-hosts, and a different bar with different co-hosts. And then by My Friends, Your Friends 10, we had 500 people on one of the rooftops of the Burj Khalifa. And then we're going into My Friends, Your Friends 20 now. And we've launched in New York, Toronto, London. We're 4,000 people in Dubai, 5,500 people globally. So it's definitely one of the brands that I'm most proud of, especially because there are people in that community that don't rely on me to be there. Like at first, of course, people would go because I was organizing it and people knew me. But now there are people that go to My Friends, Your Friends specifically to be at My Friends, Your Friends. And the brand is bigger than I am. And the community recognizes each other, which is the hallmark of a good community, is that you've got people that recognize each other independent of the organizers.
In your extensive DJ / event promotion business, which event of yours is your favorite so far and why?
My Friends, Your Friends is my favorite event, specifically for the reason that I said, is the brand that's grown the most. Like even Love Soul, which was when I was DJing in a duo with Vic, my cousin, who many people know, that built up some huge momentum. I would do birthday parties for 500 plus people in the Gherkin and places like that in London, which was awesome, all free. But My Friends, Your Friends has just grown to a much bigger database. I think it's something that's natively Dubai. And I think that's something that the people of Dubai are really, really proud of. And the fact that they go to My Friends, Your Friends, not for me, but for the co-hosts and for the brand and to spend time with each other is really, really special. When I talk to people at My Friends, Your Friends and I ask them why they come, 50% of people say that they go there to meet new people because of the new co-hosts and the new venue, etc. And 50% of people go because they want to meet their My Friends, Your Friends crew, which is the people they always meet at My Friends, Your Friends. So people get what they want from it. It's like a looking glass. They see whatever they want to see when they come to the event. And that means that everybody has somewhat of a unique experience. And I'm really proud of that.
From the beginning of your journey until now, what are the three most important things you've learned?
I think the simplest thing is be kind and have really, really good manners. You don't know by saying please and thank you to somebody or asking them what their name is or how their day is, how generous you're being by giving them some sort of dignity and recognizing them and acknowledging them. I think another thing that I've recognized is that I was told this quote, there's a long story behind it, which I'll explain another day, but he who owns the customer is king, or she who owns the customer is queen. I feel like the closer you are to your customers, the if you formalize your relationship with them, they've got your contact details, you've got their contact details, you can communicate with each other back and forth. I think that's a really, really important second lesson, and I really tell people that. Most people that have a problem with their business, I always ask them, do you have a direct relationship or an email list? And if they say no, I say that's the first thing you've got to fix. And then the third thing I think is you've just got to absolutely believe in yourself. I know it sounds corny, but you just can't give up. It doesn't matter whether you've got things going on in your business or your personal life or your health. You can't let any of them get to the nucleus, which is your brain, and mess up your mindset. You've got to be able to self-heal and self-generate and inspire yourself. And of course, the internet's great for that and mentors are great for that. But you need to be able to find that part of yourself where if somebody's able to generate it and give it to you and change the way you feel, think about how you pass that on to others and then say it to yourself. And that can often really get you out of a rut, is that you've got the same thing that you use to lift other people up can be used to lift you up. It might not take you all the way that it takes somebody else, but sometimes if that's all you've got to be able to tap into it and use it.
Yep, so that's it.
Okay, thank you so much to Visionary Magazine. We've got to go, they need the office back. And for those of you on Algo, I hope you enjoyed that. The link to this finalized, whatever they choose to put out of this interview, will be linked up in Spotify and YouTube. Hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you subscribe, like, share it with somebody who wants to find out more. And we'll catch you on the next episode of Algo. Peace.